You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And the person who's hosting with me in this hour is Amy Newman. Oops, yes, let me get all the I've dials up since I was talking beforehand. Now you're up. Okay.
Good morning, Eric. Thanks for inviting me on. This will be a nice change of pace. We get to hear you under the gun, as sometimes you have your guests on the show. Why don't we start with the question that you do typically ask most of your guests, and that's, who are you?
I'm complicated. and I've been complicated from day one. I have had a sharp mind, a very sensitive heart, and I mainly learn though through my body, and trying to get all of those things or working in the same way has been very hard for me as a child. I was in some ways a non-traditional boy, growing up on a near subsistence farm in northwest Missouri, and in pretty significant modest means, and anyone else in their right mind would call it poverty. We didn't call it poverty because we didn't need the label of dysfunction, which is what that has come to mean. But we knew that we were poor in the biblical sense. We didn't have a lot, but we made a lot. And I've also, but I've always been curious, intensely curious, intellectually, emotionally, physically curious. And I didn't know how to hold on to that without feeling like I was too much even for myself. Mm-hmm. So coming to terms with myself has been huge. But I also had the experience early in life to grow up in a community where the older folks knew that even enemies needed what it takes to thrive, or else the whole thing is going to fall apart. And in our world where you have to be right or on my side, these people were so far beyond that. So in a certain sense, postmodern, post whatever, they were pre-modern. They were traditionalists in some ways. And a lot of my life has been trying to figure out, how can we have relationships where we really know each other, really don't necessarily agree, but still look out for each other's good, mm-hmm. each other's welfare. So in a cryptic nutshell, that's who I am. Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm. I think it is. Can you talk more about the experience of growing up in poverty and how that has shaped you?
I grew up in the first years before my dad died when I was seven. We made and produced all of the food and the clothing and almost everything that we wore or ate or had. We substantially assembled or made from scratch or whatever. We bought very little. We didn't participate in the cash economy, and it taught me that there wasn't really a problem you couldn't figure out if you really put yourself to it. You could come up with something that would work. It may not be the best, or it may not be what, and it caused certain, and living like that caused certain kinds of problems. My sisters used to be ashamed that they would take homemade potato chips to school when the other kids had store-bought potato chips, and our potato chips looked a little funny, but nowadays people would want the homemade.
Sure.
but we, you know, that was, you know, because we were also a family out of step with the wider consumer culture, mm-hmm. that was at place even at that time. So we were aware of the differences, but we were kind of proud, and we were kind of known locally as being, you know, the poor kids who happened to have to be pretty smart. There were seven of us, and I'm the sixth of seven, and my parents made sure that we had three encyclopedias, and that my dad built a walnut bookcase to hold them in, so we got to read from them, and most of us read them all before the time we got out of the house.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of surprised to hear you tell the potato chip story, because I've also heard you say on air a couple of times that when you came to Cornell, it was the first time that you really knew that you were poor.
Oh, and to me, I kind of knew my sister. My sisters started leaving home when I was a year old. So, I mean, because there's a 20-year age span between the oldest and the youngest, and I'm, you know, 18, 17 half years younger than my oldest sister. So I was aware of some of their things, but I kind of laughed them off, because this was the 1960s, and my sisters would come home and this was after my father had died in 1966, and they would come home, and the challenge for women who were educated and professional was to go home and confront their mothers with what they hadn't done for them properly to, so they could grow up and differentiate from their mothers. And I watched a succession of women pass through my house coming back home to take on my mom, and they would challenge her and she would be in a puddle, and then they would leave and I would be left living with her. And for many of those years, I was the oldest boy, the oldest child at home, only 11 at the time. And that was a, that put me in kind of a caretaking role and a resentful role. But I felt that there was a challenge I was up to live toward, and I was, the thing was, I wasn't ashamed of the simpleness of our lives. We had treasures, like I could, one of the things that I've realized in the past few weeks is that when I started work at 11 and then 12 for 99 cents an hour at a grocery store, in today's dollars that would be $13 to $15, so I could buy little special things that made me feel like I could have a little guitar, an acoustic guitar. I could have a bicycle, but I could also pay for all of my clothes and help pay for stuff for the house. And by the time I was 15, I bought a third of the family car because I had made that kind of money. Because back in the day, the minimum wage was enough that a child could help support their own family. And that was just part of what I did. So I felt competent and skillful and able. And coming to Cornell made me feel incompetent. Because I hadn't learned study disciplines. You know, I'd done well because I tested well coming out of this place, but I hadn't learned study skills. And I didn't have social skills, and I had a funny accent from the Midwest. Sometimes I try to talk, but anyway, yeah, so I'll play that for that. So there were just certain things. It hit home when I was by myself. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have these people who were born in the 1880s and 1890s to kind of be understanding of me and supportive of me and the community. So I came here, and like many African American, you know, urban ghetto kids or just poor kids from wherever, when you go to a major Ivy League school, there's really nobody around that you're aware you can talk with. Mm-hmm. And so that's when you really feel the modesty and the lack of connections that you had from your upbringing. And then I began to sense that I was, in some sense, defective or poor. And it was really hard for me to kind of deal with that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But the allure of moving on had always been really present. And I'm gonna, the song that I wanted to start with was a song that's probably gonna surprise you for a rural kid from a place where there's only one house within a half a mile or two houses within a half a mile. But this is the song that played on the bus radio as I rode to school in the mornings when I was going to first grade.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the so much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure. Downtown. Everything's waiting for you. Downtown. Don't hang around and let your problems around you. There are movie shows downtown. Maybe you know some little places to go to where they never close. Downtown, just listen to the rhythm of a gentle bossa nova. You'll be dancing with them too before the night is over. Happy again. The light's so much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget you tonight. Downtown, you're gonna there. We can't forget all our troubles. Forget all our cares. So go down, down. Things will be great when you're down, down. Don't wait a minute more. Down, down. Everything's waiting for you. Down, down, down. Down, 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 down.
And that was Petula Clark performing Downtown, and that song was a song that I listened to on the bus too. And I mean, we had a 50-minute bus ride home from school at the end of the day, and only a 5 or 10-minute bus ride to school in the morning, because that's the way the circle worked. And that was played on WHB 710 on the AM dial in Kansas City, Missouri. It was the big regional pop music radio station that I grew up on before I got hooked on FM and long play records.
That song is great fun, and I think a lot of us can relate to it of a certain age. I remember growing up in a suburb of New York, and downtown, of course, is our little strip of stores. That was one version of it, but then downtown was also New York City.
The Big Apple.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things you've said, and I'm interested in talking about your transition more to Cornell, is that how you perceive Ithaca depends largely on where you came from. So can you talk about how that was for you?
Oh, okay. I came from a community that was pretty stable, and that in 1969, about three-quarters of the kids from this rural high school would go on to college, two-thirds to three-quarters. By 1979, I came in, only about a third would go on to college from high school. People's aspirations were declining. The economy, rural economy, oil embargo jacked up farm prices, put everybody in debt. People began to get wary of cities, and they began to become suspicious of, you know, civil rights became not so much an idea of people getting what they need and what they deserve, but getting what they demand. And for traditional people, being demanding is the last thing. You want to be forceful. You want to be convincing. My school began to fall apart. And when I was... one of the things that I had done is I had earned enough money to be an exchange student. But when I was away as an exchange student in Colombia, before I even got to Cornell, there was an incident where some beer was found in a locker room during a basketball game in a junior high team. And it caused such a stink that the school administration wasn't monitoring the coaches and the kids enough that things escalated, and it led to the superintendent and principal being fired, which may seem a little excessive, but in 1976, you know, I mean, that was the way it was there. Well, I wrote, as a kid, I'd been able to write the code of conduct for the school system for youth that got it through the student senate and got it accepted by the board. I was able to have a role of leadership, and I challenged the school for driving out these guys who had been so supportive of kids learning because of an incident that was largely out of their control, but under everybody's noses, because people were selling massive amounts of alcohol and pot in one parking lot in the middle of town, and so I wrote a letter, talked about all of the, 1 out of 20 of my peers would die before they got to the age of 20 because of alcohol or drug-related issues or suicides or driving too fast on bad roads, all sorts of reasons, but real high death rate. Mm-hmm. And I challenged the town on why they were doing, you know, why they were blaming the school officials for something they were let happen by not enforcing the laws, by not monitoring their kids, by not doing this stuff. And I wrote an editorial, and it was published. And it turns out that my... I had a family member who was actually part of the selling of the alcohol. And it was, you know, very complicated stuff. Mm. So I went off to college feeling somewhat shaken. Because in the middle of the night, I was driving home in the middle of the night, and somebody decided to try to run me off the road or play with me just so that they would run me off the road.
Wow.
and mess with my mind and hem me in a parking lot and rock my car so that I would be afraid for not being able to get out. I was attacked. I was assaulted, but not physically assaulted, but my car was.
Sure.
And so coming to Cornell, I thought would be liberation. I can get away from this place that's in free fall. Like, it was becoming a rural ghetto. which is really what it became for a few years afterwards. But Cornell, I ended up, this was 1976, you know, they had keg parties on West Campus where they, you know, unlimited, you know, food and unlimited beer, and this was before the drinking age was raised and before they really kind of figured it out. And a week of partying, and I came to college. College was my ticket out. I had a full scholarship to Cornell, need-based scholarship. And I saw kids just getting plastered and just getting totally wasted, and it was so loud you couldn't focus. And I had an interesting, I had a conservative Jewish roommate from Chicago I found really interesting, but we lived on a floor that was just a party hall. And it was hard, so I moved to the International Living Center second semester so that it could be a little quieter.
You must have been in the U-Hauls then.
I was in the U-Hauls. Sure. And I ran for the University Senate for the last year that it actually existed as a really powerful thing with a real budget. And I won. In a field of five candidates with like 49% of the vote. I could hustle even coming straight out of the farm, even as a hayseed. But I began to flounder when I started my first semester. I chose to take 1 6 credit course and 2 3 credit courses where I could really master the material and work at a pace that made sense to me. But the system required that you take 15. Large courses, you know, courses with 50 to 200, 300 people in them. And second semester, I began to 15 to 20 credits.
Right.
And I just began to flounder. And my relational skills and my smarts just, I didn't have the study skills. I didn't know what to aim for. And I kind of became really needy in terms of relationships with women and insecure and did not have a sense of hope or purpose. So I dropped out. I didn't drop out, but I took a leave of absence, lost a semester scholarship because I left in the middle of my fifth semester. And I worked construction, sweeping up charcoal and plaster and stuff from the house on the corner of Eddy Street and Seneca Street. We had a fire in it. It was the first gut rehab, I think, that Mac Travis did. Once he started, you know, in a more aggressive way, doing development in Ithaca, and I was a grunt. And eventually, I painted that place out, and I did painting for contract because I'd learned how to paint and do some light carpentry stuff as a kid growing up. And that was an environment that I felt like I had some skill in. I wasn't perfect, but I had enough skill that I could survive. And I was not going to lose. I wasn't going to go back home to Missouri with my tail tucked. I was going to stay and continue to live with the Cornell students that I've been living with, most of whom were from the New York metro area, and figure out how they obviously were doing something that I couldn't figure out. And so I spent that year doing physical labor, watching them.
What was your mother's reaction during this time? And actually, I'd love to hear your mother's reaction to when you first went away to college, too, because it sounds like she was quite dependent on you. Your father had died, and at that point, there were just two of you left in the house.
This is providence in some interesting sorts of ways. My mother initially worked as a nurse's aide after our dad died for the minimum wage, and then she worked part-time as an assistant librarian, but they couldn't keep her there because she had no college education. So she had to go back to the nursing home, but she did activity directing, which was programming for people the residents in nursing homes in those days were not as severely ill as they are now, because they weren't the same requirements. Anyway, a fellow came into the nursing home probably 1972 or 3, who was in his late 60s, who had just kind of went on a drinking binge and kind of basically they dried him out in the military hospital in Kansas. It's very famous. Anyway, I'm blocking on the name of it. Anyway, he came to the nursing home. He was virtually blind, unable to walk, wheelchair bound, and she had kind of built a relationship with him, and he began to get better. His vision came back a bit. He became strong enough he could walk. And then he started playing the piano, and he played the piano by ear. And eventually she learned that he had played saxophone with the Dorsey brothers in the 1920s.
Wow.
And that he had played later played piano when his front teeth got kicked out and he couldn't play the sax anymore in a brawl. And he had had a life. He had composed music, some of which had been published, but never recorded. And he was just a really interesting guy who had a really sharp wit, But he was a guy who had burned through four marriages, abandoned three or four children. When he was in his 40s and he finally decided to, or 50s, he finally decided to put his life back together. He went home to take care of mom in Savannah, Missouri, where he was a short order cook, which is what he'd done most of his life. And when she died, his reason for living stopped and he just drank himself under. Mm. He dried out. He became a living person. And he, when I went to college, he became the focus of my mother's life. And he actually consciously did that. And when my younger brother was ready to graduate from high school, he asked us both, could he ask our mother if he could marry her? Mm. Because, you know, he knew that she was going to want to get off the farm, and he could buy her a new house and a new piano. And he was functional enough at that point that he was reliable. And in many ways, he was undoing the damage that he had done. Mm-hmm. But trying, and my mother helped him reunite with his children that he had all abandoned, who had tremendous issues with him. Mm-hmm. And her focus became him. And they had five wonderful years together before he died of lung cancer and emphysema. Mm-hmm. So her feelings, she was concerned about me, but she had finally gotten a life of her own, and he knew what he was doing because he knew he was saving his own soul in a sense, but his doing it allowed us the space to move on, which neither my younger brother and I might have had had he not stepped up to the plate.
Sure.
It's a long story, but it's a very beautiful story. My mother married a man out of a nursing home.
Yeah, that's a great story.
It's a story of redemption on so many levels.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we go to some more of your music?
Okay. I'm going to play, this is kind of a melancholy song, and it reflects my religious roots. And it is a traditional hymn that was my grandfather's favorite song. And growing up, I sang in the choir with my mother and my grandfather. He sang bass, I sang tenor, and my mother was a soprano, and well, an alto, depending upon how old she was. Her voice drops. People's voices drop with age.
Abide with me, fast falls eventide, the darkness deepens, Lord, with me
abide with me.
morning breaks, and earthling shadows flee. In life and death, O Lord, abide with me.
In life and death, O Lord, abide with me. And that song has a particular resonance, not just because it was my grandfather's favorite, but where I grew up, over half of the population was over age 65. And so death was a constant. Mm-hmm. Death was a constant. And youth were rare. And people put all of their hopes in youth until there was this kind of abandonment when we became more of a ghetto than a viable community. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Why don't we talk more about the role that religion has had in your life and where it is now, and like most of your life, I think it's complicated.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell this in a different way than I've told it in the past. When I left Missouri to come to Cornell in 1976, I could not find a community, a religious community. I could find religious worship. I could find, you know, people were either on this. I attended services among Protestants, evangelicals, Catholics, and Jews, looking for a spiritual home. None of them worked for me because they either tended to be on this kind of deeper spiritual inward journey about making yourself all good and right, or on this social justice journey where they were going to go out and fix the world. And I grew up in a traditional environment where the way we lived our lives is the way we shape the world, and the two are completely integrated. And the only place that I found on campus that reflected that level of personal and public integration were the Social Democrats. And Ben Nichols was one of the leaders of them. He later became mayor of Ithaca. And so that's where I found my religious spirituality lived out, with a secular Jewish fellow, I think. Well, no, I'm not sure if he was Jewish, but there was a strong history of secular Judaism within that group. And actually, those are many of the people that I connected with at Cornell were secular Jewish people from secular Jewish backgrounds, and partly that's because they thought I looked Jewish. But that was, anyway,
I think that speaks to, though, your sometimes overly broad definition of religion that people tend to challenge you on.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people would say that it's a political organization, and sure, there were some religious people within that organization, but what is, maybe
no, they
tell
were,
us?
They weren't religious people. They were people that understood that the personal is political, and the political, that was the motto of that time. The personal is political, the political is personal. And that integration was something coming out of the late 60s and 70s, which was a way of life.
Well, why don't you tell us what religion means to you?
Okay. And this is good. This is good. I don't use a spooky definition of religion. I don't use a definition of religion that's tied to any religious tradition, because I think that's unfair. And spooky is just, you know, if you want to set something up like a straw man to dismiss it, then, you know, spooky is all about, supernatural and irrational and whatever. And I don't do that. That's that, to me, that's profoundly disrespectful of religious people, is to define religion as just about supernatural, spooky stuff, because that's not how I see it lived. And I don't see it tied to any particular religion. So as I have learned over the years, religion, probably the best source of the word religion is the Latin term religare, which can mean, which most likely means to religament. Ligaments are what hold our bodies together. The ligaments are what hold an entity together. And so, and religament means to put together again when things have been torn apart. And I, you know, so a person's religion is how they see the world held together. But it's not just how they say they see it. And this is where I'm kind of shrewd and pushy, because I have never met a person from this functional definition of religion who's not religious. And if I want to know what their religion is, I ask them, when did things really fall apart in your work, in your life, or in the world around you? And what did you do to try to put them back together again? Because that's an honest, what you answer that question, well, not to what you answer, because that may be a rationalization, but what if I can watch you put it back together again, then I know practically what your religion is, what your actions, what your emotion, what your intellectual thoughts are. That's your religion.
I think I've taken issue with that for two reasons, because I have been asked that question, and as an atheist, I feel challenged by it and almost backed into a corner, because having a more traditional religion, believing in God, sure, that would be helpful to one who is suffering some sort of loss.
Not necessarily. Yeah.
Oh, but I think that's the presumption of it. Okay, well, that's one.
Yeah, that's one. And that's an assumption people make, but I've known so many people who've suffered enormously because of their inability to come to terms with their belief of God. I mean, they have it, and it's just oppressive.
The other contradiction I see is you're saying it's re-ligament, but also you're saying it's how people see the world tied together. So it's not just in times of loss. It's how the world is sort of constructed together.
Right. But but most of the time, and this is partly because part of my personality and part of my skill set is I tend to work in high crisis and high conflict settings, as a emergency room chaplain, as a cancer and HIV AIDS chaplain, studying some of the most violent neighborhoods in the U.S. in Detroit and Chicago and New York. You know, I tend to go to I'd be drawn to the places where the things are really intense, and I grew up in what was becoming a rural ghetto with a fair amount of violence. To me, The best quick measure is what people do when things fall apart. But you're right. It's just how we see things. Now, one of the things that I've done through Shared Journeys is, which is the group that I work for, is we have created 37 symbols that are secular, religious, scientific, cultural, political, economic, that all are ways of intellectually And these mostly refer to intellectual ways of understanding how the world is and ought to be. So yes, and I do what I'm doing what you're saying in that effort. But sometimes I get pushy and I use this harsher standard. But the harsher standard actually is what oftentimes expose where people are in a pinch. And I've dealt with, and maybe it's not true, maybe people would do better if they weren't in a pinch, but oftentimes what people do in a pinch is really indicative of where they live.
I think the symbols are a good example of your very broad definition of religion, right? Which includes atheism.
Right, because it's a discipline. It's an approach to life, and usually based within a notion of reason and highly intellectual and not so much emphasizing the physical. And
I've heard you also describe religion as just reality.
Right. And one of the things that has reality from a subjective point of view, one of the things that's become really clear to me recently as I've had more conversations with more folks is that science and you know, I'm trained in the social sciences as well as in religion, I like the discipline and the rigor that comes with science and the demand that what you do be to some extent justifiable as an objective assessment of what's going on that can be replicated by others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that science and this standard of objectivity and replicability is really, really important. Religious texts and religious practices are almost always subjective. They're from the point of view of God, or they're from the point of view of an individual or a group, and works entirely differently to make subjective claims. Mm-hmm. And so there is no conflict between science and religion when you use these very clear, what I call functional definitions. And I think we could put a lot of angst to rest if we would just talk about what does religion do well and how are people trying to put their worlds together, or how do they see them, what works and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and traditions are always evolving. Even if they're given by God, they are interpreted by each generation, sometimes in significant ways, oftentimes consistently, but there's room for play.
Mm-hmm.
It has become more clear that I need to be absolutely clear with others that a religious point of view is always a subjective point of view, but nobody lives without both a sense of what's subjectively present and what's objectively present. Religion is reality from a subjective point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And science tends to want to be the objective point of view. I'm rambling.
So what? Yeah, let's personalize it a little bit. Right. What role do you see religion playing in your life today?
There's nothing that I do that's not reflective, that in some sense is not religious. This is outside the conventional, you know, some of the traditional practices. I come from a low church tradition. My tradition spawned the Christian anarchists of the mid-19th century, as well as the agrarian revolt for rural cooperatives. So there's always been a strong tie between what's conventionally considered religion and political and economic within my tradition. So where is my spirituality, where's my religion in my life? When I sing, when I you do physical labor without shame, it exercises my body, it keeps me healthy, and being able to say, even if I'm doing a desk job, to know that I have a 30-minute walk to and from that desk job, it means that I'm taking care of my body and using it in a purposeful sort of way without having to make what I would call a fetish of it by going to a gym. And I know that's a powerful judgmental statement, but if we build into our lives the emotional, intellectual, and physical complexity that keeps us healthy, then we don't have to have these specialized functions, which are very expensive, and they eat up a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. In a world where we need to be concerned about sustainability, we need to make everything we do multiple things.
Yeah, I get the connection, yeah. Roughly. I think, yeah, a lot of people would struggle with seeing this as religion,
yeah,
and religious practice.
And that's fine. And an anthropology professor who was one of my undergraduate advisors said, so what's not religion?
Yeah,
that's a good question.
And
so what is not religion is anything that's from an objective point of view. And anything that is done in that scientific sort of way. But everything can be apprehended, as opposed to comprehended, from a subjective point of view. So everything is under the purview of religion as a subjective experience.
Sure, absolutely. Because there is a lot of subjectivity in science, of course.
Well, there is, but also when one of the really neat things about when you get people who practice different religious disciplines and they all come to the same conclusion because in some sense they're mature and they're seeing clearly because they understand what it means to be an observer and an engager in life, when they come to the same, they achieve what's near objectivity, though we don't recognize it. You know, science suffers from the contamination sometimes of subjectivity, but also gets new insights. Religion sometimes comes to such an amen consensus on something that you've achieved objectivity. We don't think practically enough about how the two should relate without getting all our panties in a wad about what's going on. That we don't see how complementary they can be.
Yeah. Well, and mostly people are defending one or the other. I appreciate your previous guest talking about holding two truths.
Yes.
Yeah.
I
think that's really where you're getting at.
And I grew up learning how to love people who really couldn't love each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you do that, and this was because my parents' dreams, while they were wonderful, had soured. And there was conflict, and there was also conflict in the community. But when you learn to love people who cannot love each other, when you learn to hold two competing truths in your head, then wisdom has a chance.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we go to another musical selection?
Sure, sure. I'm going to play something which is very brief, and this is my favorite music in the world. And most people who know me don't even know that. Not even my children knew this until they asked me what my favorite music was, because I don't share this often with people.
Hmm.
Thank you.
And that was Francesco de Milano's Fantasia 16, performed by Richard McKenzie on the lute. Lute music at about 1 minute each, fantasias from the Renaissance, are my favorite kind of music. They capture the way in which my mind works when I'm at peace. And it's just, and I they are like a touchstone. You want to, when I want to calm myself down, what I hear is that.
It's pretty. I could see where you may not want to listen to more than a minute of it.
Yes.
One of the things I really like about your show is hearing about people locally and their connection to Ithaca, because it makes me feel like I know them, or maybe I know someone who knows them. So why don't we talk a little bit more about what you appreciate about Ithaca. I think we know what brought you here initially. It was Cornell. Mm-hmm. I know you haven't stayed here consistently, but what does Ithaca mean to you?
That that is what it means to me now. I almost didn't come back here because, as an undergrad with a person who could speak sympathetically of religious points of view and I tended to find other ways to look at things. For example, when I was working on my senior thesis on issues of sexuality, reproduction, and abortion, most people frame it as a right to life or a right to privacy, right to choose. And I found a reproductive equity position, which explains most people's thinkings on the issue, as well as the complexity. But we tend to live in a world, and Ithaca at that time was extremely polarized, so to present a coherent third way of thinking about an issue was kind of challenging, and I've struggled to come to terms with what I value in a place where back in the 80s, the 70s and 80s was openly hostile to religion here. People would mock you in the classroom if you made a statement that was favorable of religious practice or belief, and they would kind of question your one of my really best professors I had at Cornell said he was worried when I went to seminary that I would shut my mind off. He kind of no clue that, you know, I had the critical, inquiring, self-reflective, and self-critical professors that I had in seminary, one out of two. At Cornell, one out of four, one out of five at best. And that, at that level of kind of crossing the boundary of the personal and the intellectual and the public, just was not a very good experience. So why did I come back?
Yeah.
Well, because it was close to where it was a program that I felt that I could negotiate through city and regional planning, local economic development planning, mm-hmm. which is where I did my my doctoral work. But it was within a short distance of New York City, where all of my in-laws were living, and they were getting old. Mm-hmm. And it did prove, indeed, that we needed to be near them as they were aging and dying, and that was a good decision. And what I have come to see here is that as times change, people have become more open to multiple perspectives. And in a place which is very intellectual, but you also have a lot, very artsy, emotional crowd, and you have people who are strong experiential physical learners. I have found a little puddle here where I can kind of play in. And I'm hopefully becoming, there are things we don't see about ourselves, is that we export the working poor because they cannot live here. We are beautiful territory, but it's largely land that's healed over from the damage from industrialization or industrial agriculture. You know, there are things that we're not really honest with ourselves about here that I like to be able to kind of hold up, but I also don't want to be just a dismissible clanging gong, because I enjoy being able to rest in the tension. And Ithaca is a place with lots of diversity, but not a lot of strong, intimate community across differences. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what I love to work on here. It's an interesting challenge, and it's at a scale which is big enough that we have a global citizenship here. But it's a small enough city that we can actually mostly know each other or know about each other or very quickly learn. And that I like. So mm-hmm. I'm in a sense in kind of a life that's a natural experiment.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that's what keeps you here.
Yeah.
Your own evolution and how Ithaca has changed.
Right. And wanting to be part of that. And just, you know, I know that it takes 10 to 20 years to establish oneself somewhere, mm-hmm. 10 to 20 years to do anything that matters, another 10 to 20 years to institutionalize it. Mm-hmm. At 50, almost 56, I can't move and do anything with my life. given the what I want to impact is community. I've already got, 30, I don't know how many I've been here for, 28 of 38 years here. I don't want to waste that.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us more about how you have changed over time? You want to take a musical break
I'm going to take a musical break, and this one is a Mason Williams and Classical Gas, and this is how my mind works when I'm hyper. Was Mason Williams' Classical Gas.
It's a good example of how, although I listen to your show often and enjoy it almost always, sometimes when the music comes on, that's when I take a break.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So I started asking you how you've changed over time. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
I think I have become more able to live I found more the courage of my convictions with less anger and fear, and that dynamic. I see things, I'm not as afraid of being hurt. I know when things are going to be hurtful, to try to measure the consequences of that hurting of others. And I'm just trying to become more skillful, because our communities are where our struggles are meaningful. Otherwise,
maybe you could give us an example from your personal life.
I was teaching a class and I was explaining something which was really kind of to students where I was contradicting what everybody in the room had said. And I told them up front, I don't have a fight with you. I'm not trying to provoke you. I'm not trying to correct you. I'm trying to create a space here where I can say something that is so very different from what's been said here. Mm-hmm. And I just want you to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not trying to pick an argument. I'm not trying to win you over. I'm not trying to convince you. I'm just trying to create a space where I can be.
And that preamble tends to offset a debate.
Yes. Or it makes the debate focus on clarity rather than
who's right and who's wrong.
Right and who's wrong. Yeah. Absolutely. It has taken me a long time to tell people up front what I'm trying to do. Mm. And like you were saying before, I didn't get the punchline with my mom's story was that she met a man when I went away to college, but she'd met a man before that. But I didn't get to it till like 5 minutes into the story.
I teach business communication, so we like our main points up front.
Yeah. And I get it. And I try to honor that more. And I also, you know, I have, because of the extreme situations I've lived in, I've oftentimes lived around more anger and violence than is healthy. Mm. And I have not realized how damaging that is. Anger is really good as a signal emotion. It tells you that something's wrong and you need to fight or flee or get clear about what you need to make a change. Mm-hmm. Something needs to happen here. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it's not a really good guide for activity. But it has a good signal that there are things that needs to happen. I think I can honor that signal without succumbing to expressing a lot of excessive anger. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that I can. I know that, you know, one of my children was able to kind of differentiate and kind of push off of me, and kind of that's dad's issue. I'm not going to take it on. And another one, I think, really suffered from my being an angry dad. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I am changing, but you can't undo what you've done. I mean, we can live into different ways and try, but and then also it will be that child's life.
Yeah.
As it is my life and how it was changed by my parents who had their own issues.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. How do you restore yourself? This is a great question you ask guests. How do you find a sense of balance in your life today?
I need to work or exercise to physical exhaustion at some regular intervals. Mm-hmm. Ideally, I build it into my life on a daily basis. That does not happen. I need to sing. I need to know my body as an instrument of music and work it that way. I spend 1 hour a day reading, mostly newspaper stuff. But I spend at least an hour a day reading every day, first thing, and thinking and just spacing out or meditating. I have had a practice of serious meditation in the past, and I so thoroughly internalized it that all I have to do is assume the posture, and I will relax and go into the mood. Mm. And so for me, as with many others who have a spiritual discipline, once you really learn it, you don't have to be rigid about it. Mm. It has become parts of your body, parts of your mind, part of your heart. And so that's what I do. I like to dance, you know, but in general, I want to do that by myself. I want to do expressive dance in a large space by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice. Is there anything else that you think listeners should know about you?
I guess I try to be open and as little defensive as possible to people who fundamentally disagree. Mm-hmm. And if there are things that are said on the show that need to be challenged or come back at, I'm gonna make sure those things get on air. I'm gonna make sure that people get on air that I believe that we are all made stronger when what each of us values is more clearly presented in public. Mm-hmm. And how what we value is lived in our lives. Not an issue, not an intellectual issue, not an emotional mm-hmm. issue, but how we live it.
I have heard you push people that way. And yet I'm sure you want people to know that they won't be intimidated. You are kind about it.
And that for me is a change. Mm. I mean, it's a change for me to do it in a public space. It's a change for me to do it in the private space with my children. I'm getting better at it. I did it as a hospital chaplain. I did it as a pastor. I've had to learn how to take that skill into more environments mm-hmm. as I grow up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really been a long process and will continue to be of discovery and growing up. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's important about me is that I learned at a very early age that I could build up hype for something and I could convince people to do stuff. And I was never the elected student leader, but I was the organizer. in my high school, and we'd get people doing stuff. And I realized a few times people did stuff that I asked them to do that was kind of stupid, like certain rings that we were exchanging as friends or whatever, or that I had kind of gotten everybody to think about this calculation that we were doing as a group math problem, and I got them thinking about it in the wrong way because I hadn't misunderstood it. And I learned very early that I could totally mislead people because I could be so very convincing. And it has made it that on a sense, certain sense, shame, but also an awareness of the responsibility of leadership has made it really hard for me to step out at times when it might be helpful. Mm-hmm. And my peers in high school, when they were creating the yearbook, which had, you know, a musical piece for every student, they dubbed me with the Carole King hit Jazz Man. And so that's the song we're going to close out today with.
Nice. Okay. Well, thank you, Eric.
Amy Newman, thank you for being willing to interview me and to push me a little bit, and you could push a little further, but we, you know, thank you. Thank you.
Lift me, won't you lift me above the old routine? Make it nice, play it. So